Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from Biden's tax proposals to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can follow me on Twitter at XBorderTax. On this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks, I'm excited to have Chris Desmond back on the podcast. Chris is a Chicago-based transfer pricing partner and leads our global trade services practice. Chris, welcome back to the podcast.
Doug, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
Well, Chris, before we dive into the topic at hand, I'm always excited to have a fellow National League Central fan on the podcast. And for our international listeners, that is a Major League Baseball reference. It's spring training now. We're in the midst of, or the beginning of spring training. And I had to remind myself, interestingly, that the Cubs actually won our division last year by three games. When I was looking at that, it reminded me that we actually had four teams from the National League Central that made the expanded playoffs last year. And if you remember, all of us lost in the first round in the three-game series. I believe maybe you guys got swept. I think we lost in three to the Padres. But, you know, looking forward, you know, my St. Louis Cardinals have made some big moves, including acquiring, you know, arguably the best third baseman in the National League to really solidify the middle of our lineup. And I'm really excited about it. But do you have any prognostications for the National League Central and what anything news to report from your Cubs over the offseason and how you think you guys might fare?
I feel like the Cubs, you know, with the amount of folks they let go, they let Darvish go to the Dodgers, Schwarber's gone, you know, they don't have Lester anymore. It's been kind of a one-year contract for free agency. Everybody just assumes they're tanking. And this morning I went to Baseball Prospectus to say, okay, well, what's the NL Central looking like? Do you know who they have leading the NL Central, Doug? Any idea?
Is it the Cubs?
For 2020? No.
Is it the Cubs? Is it the
Cardinals? No, it's not. No, it's not.
Is it the Reds?
It's the Brewers.
The Brewers.
It's the Brewers.
I think it's going to be competitive again. They've got great pitching, obviously. It's going to be a fun. I mean, it was a really fun division last year, and hopefully it'll be similar to that. Very, very highly competitive. So time will tell.
I do too, and I never write off the Cardinals. Any Cubs fan knows this from decades and decades of torment from those Cardinals. They always find a way to win. They always have a great team. So my actual bet is on the Cards to win the division if I had to make a prediction. And I got a question for you, Doug. So something happened in the offseason that I felt as though was kind of big news, at least from a Chicago perspective. And I want to hear your take. So it dealt with one of your old managers, La Russa. What do you think about La Russa coming back and coaching the White Sox?
Listen, Tony was a strategist like no other manager I have ever witnessed. And I know he's just a huge fan of the game. So he's a huge personality. I found the number of pitching changes admittedly annoying, even as a diehard Cardinals fan. But I will sacrifice those for the World Series that he brought to the team. And listen, I actually think it's good for baseball. And I think it's neat that he's coming back. And I look forward to hearing more from him. Obviously, he's been in baseball the entire time, but to see him take the reins again, I'm actually excited about. So, all right. Well, we don't want to turn this in. As much as I would enjoy turning this into a sports podcast, I'm sure many of our listeners have very little interest in Major League Baseball, so I appreciate you bearing with us. We're here to talk about trade. And frankly, as a tax guy who spent over 20 years in the profession, it really has seemed the last couple of years, you know, particularly with the Trump administration and the number of policy changes that were made, has really brought trade to the forefront. Before we discuss kind of the big picture and what we're seeing today, particularly with the new Biden administration, what I was wondering from you, given the experience you have with a number of both, you know, inbound and outbound multinationals, so U.S.-based and non-U.S.-based multinationals, one of the challenges that I see within organizations is kind of how trade and tax coordinate. And sometimes trade kind of rolls up through tax. I think maybe more often than not, it doesn't. That might be from some of my limited experiences. But can you share with our audience kind of what you see insofar as how trade and tax interrelate within a big multinational corporation and any best practices that, that you see to make sure those teams are coordinated?
Wonderful question. And one of the things, Doug, is that myself being a tax practitioner over the last couple of decades and coming over to the trade side to help think through how do we help mitigate what's happened related to the 301 Trump tariffs and how do we then look at what that means not only from a trade but tax perspective, it really opened the door to how there are real silos within an organization when it comes to the customs and trade team versus that of the tax team. And more often than not, they never chat. And usually, like when we've over our career put together structures, we always look at the impact and then we said, oh, we need to bring in trade just to make sure we're not tripping anything. But the impact wasn't that material. Usually it was a minor piece, but we just needed to know what it was. With what's just happened over the last couple of years with the tariffs and jumping from a 0% rate to 25% in some industries and seeing that impact across industries and supply chains, if the tax team and the customs and trade team are not talking and the tax team is perhaps considering some change due to, you know, U.S. tax reform or some other aspect of the business, and if they're not bringing in the trade team, the impact, the above the line cash impact, positive or negative, is so material that it's something where if those two teams are not gelled by now, that could be a problem for a multinational organization, and they need to be. And so that's one thing that I've found is to really make sure those teams come together, thinking through what they're considering from a tax and trade perspective and understand, kind of like when you go through modeling, what that impact is from a holistic perspective, because you have to really think about that as you're going through from a company perspective. So that's where I see the teams actually coming together usually. But if they haven't yet, it's obviously a best practice recommendation going forward.
Do you see any common features insofar as whether trade actually reports up into tax, or are those, you know, typically and separate, just as far as how they're structured? And if you were given your background in tax and you know, all the time that you spent in trade over the last few years, would you have kind of a recommendation for a multinational insofar as how they might structure that?
Absolutely. And one of the things I've seen is that over the last couple of years, the trade and customs group didn't actually coordinate or go up through tax. They might have had a dotted line that actually eventually went to the CFO. With what's happened in the last couple of years with the tariffs, and all of a sudden the trade team has to report almost directly, not only to the CFO, but the board on potential impacts today, but going forward, then the board and CFO are hearing about the potential tax impacts and changes. And they're like, we got to get this coordinated. So we've actually seen a movement where the customs and trade team have then actually become reporting up to the tax team, which is a great thing because then that forces the teams to actually coordinate on initiatives, coordinate on forecasts, what's happening with logistics and supply chain. And that's actually a really good best practice that we've seen some companies moving towards. But when they're actually autonomous, and some companies have kept that autonomous, there has to be some sort of initiative or working group that allows those teams to come together and talk, because if they don't, again, that could be, you know, wreak havoc from an overall impact on the financials of what's being done by the two teams independently.
Very, very helpful. And we'll come back at the end of the podcast and talk about, you know, some other advice we might have for tax teams from a trade standpoint. But let's set the table with respect to where we are currently from a trade perspective. You know, obviously, it's been a busy few years since the Trump administration. We now have the new Biden administration. Policies are starting to take shape as, you know, he is solidifying his cabinet, and those approvals are still going through. But maybe just take us through a big picture kind of the trade landscape today, particularly with the new administration, but also what we're seeing outside the U.S.
So the last couple of years, Doug, have been such a monstrous change for a multinational company, because not only did we have tax reform, which everybody was reeling from that. Tax directors are trying to think, what does that mean to my company? What does it mean? What is these new terms of GILTI and FDII? But then on the trade side, so a lot of these trade rules have been around. So in the trade world, we actually have code and regs as well. And we had a change to the regs that have been around since, you know, 1700s, dealing with the Trade Facilitation Act on how tariffs can be applied, but also what's that look back period for that. So we had a big change in the regulations allowing, instead of a 3-year look back, a 5-year look back on imports paid, which then helps with actually mitigation strategies. They also induced some other types of rules related to matching for an area called duty drawback, which for some industries, they never had the opportunity to get refunds related to duty drawback. This allowed for that to happen. This was a huge change, just as impactful as tax reform in the trade space. They did not anticipate at the same time levying these Trump tariffs, or what they call 301s, related to, you know, putting an additional uplift of 25% on goods imported from China. And you could see that the 301s were being used for other retaliatory measures related to the Trump administration. So basically you have this trifecta of things that a company, the trade teams and the tax teams, have to manage, the supply chain teams within a company are trying to manage. From a CFO perspective, I think that I'd be, you know, losing more and more hair if I was in that position. And then last year, since we both love baseball, the curveball came and we also have COVID. That's four things that a company has to balance related to all of these factors. And when they do the modeling of what that means, current, state, and future, this has been a very, very challenging environment. And this has just happened as of today. Now we have a new administration. And that new administration is going to go through and say, all those areas we just talked about, there might be changes to reel it back, move potentially some of the things we see on tax reform, increase the corporate tax rate. From the tariff perspective, we might actually see tariffs being sustained as they are now, or we may see some changes where they might go down. So there's a lot of unknown that's happening now. So trying to plan ahead for those unknowns has become a very challenging time for many multinationals, and a lot's going to come out in the next several months with the change in the Biden administration one on the trade side, and even with the nomination for Katherine Tai for the next U.S. trade representative. What is that agenda going to look like related to our negotiations with China, as well as what that might mean for other, you know, global trade negotiations that we might have that will then have an impact to our supply chains?
All right, so let's unpack some of those. And
that was a lot. Sorry about that. I get excited about this, Doug.
No, this is fantastic. You know, I, as do I. So a couple of just clarifying things for some of us that are less savvy on the trade talk. My first question for clarification is Section 301. When I think of 301, Section 301, the tax nerd in me says, all right, well, that's the amount, that's the code provision that applies to determining the amount of a dividend distribution or the consequences of a distribution from a corporation. I am certain that that is not what you are talking about. Can you share what is this 301 process that you referenced?
Section 301 of the Trade Act. So no dividends here. We're talking about the Trade Act of 1974. That's where the U.S. Trade Representative has really a broad authority on the range of responsive actions when there is something that either the government, the president, as you saw in the last couple of years, feel as though that there are unfair practices related to the position of the U.S. related to duties, goods, and other services. And one of the things that first came out, and even you heard when Trump was running for president, is the concerns that he had related to China on intellectual property, stealing trade secrets, feeling as though that there was too much aggressiveness related to trade. And so because the authority is broad, Trump allow the use of 301s to say, hey, I want to have an investigation made on what's going on with China and whether or not we feel as though that they are being unfair to U.S. trade, in which it was found they were. Therefore, that allowed Trump to then administer some sort of consequence or basically implementing the 301s of a tariff. And so a tariff related to goods being imported into the U.S. And so think of it this way, Doug. Imagine in the world of tax we're in today, what if they increase the corporate tax rate by 25%? I mean, that would be monstrous, right? That's what we saw on the trade side. But keep in mind, we're talking above the line. This is a direct hit to cost of goods sold from the importation of goods into the U.S. from China. This has caused several companies and industries havoc on their supply chains, in which we've seen a tremendous amount of companies go out of business last year, or even gone through severe hardships combined with COVID. It's been a challenging time. So this is where companies are really needing to stay ahead of things. And really, you got to keep an eye on the 301s, because hopefully we might see that ratchet down under Catherine Tai in the next administration from a trade rep. But that's really going to be dependent upon the negotiations with China, because right now we have a position with China with these tariffs in place. And so to be able to use that to negotiate is going to be helpful.
Yeah, one of the things that I find interesting is, you know, historically, you know, the Republican position with respect to trade and tariffs, you know, what was different than the Trump administration, to say the least. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how closely aligned this new Democratic administration and Democratic Congress aligns with some of those Trump policies. But we'll find out. The other question, kind of follow up from a definitional perspective, is you had mentioned duty drawback. Can you explain to me and the listeners what that is? I think of it kind of like the VAT recovery, but that might be an overly simplistic view of the world. I'm certain it is. But can you talk a little bit about what duty drawback is that you had mentioned earlier?
Yeah, so this has been around since 1789, if you can believe it. And basically, the U.S. duty drawback program allows a company who imports products into the United States, they usually pay different types of fees. So you have your 301 Trump tariffs, you have your standard duties, merchandise processing fees, harbor maintenance fees, and in some industries you have excise taxes. Those five amounts are paid every time a product are imported in the United States. Duty drawback says, hey, if you are going to then have a export that aligns with the import, and there's different forms of duty drawback. It could be the direct tracing of the product, which is called direct ID. Part of the new TIFT rules that I mentioned earlier that came out in February 2019 allowed some expansiveness related to substitution. If you're allowed to match a qualified export with an import, you get 99% back on what you paid on the import as a refund from U.S. Customs. That's a big amount, because if you go looking into the Wall Street Journal or the financials of companies, you'll see millions and sometimes tens and hundreds of millions of dollars that have been paid over the last year in tariffs. Duty drawback allows you to take 5 years of history of the imports paid, and those import entries is like, to me, think of it like a tax credit. And if you can find a qualified export to match against that, they have a 5-year shelf life. That's 99 cents on the dollar. That's big cash, but it's not an easy exercise. Very difficult projects and analyses. But it's something that has become more widely used to allow companies to have a little bit more breathing room when it comes to what we've seen from the 301 tariffs. And so as cash refunds, that's actually opportunistic. And then you think about those cash refunds, the question becomes, how are they treated from a tax perspective? And so this is where the pieces of the tax team need to align with what's going on in the trade team, because there could be things that are happening that one can account for to maybe help out with FDII, how we're thinking about different attribute planning. So this is, again, because of things like this, companies need to really align up with their strategies.
Very, very helpful. All right. So let's move to what we're seeing with respect to potential tariffs related to some of the digital service taxes. So we've spent a lot of time here on the cross-border tax talks talking about the OECD, BEPS 2.0, and recently had Will Morris, our global policy leader, on talking about some of the unilateral actions that we know a number of companies are taking within the EU and around the world with respect to corporate tax matters. And many of them focused on digital service taxes that, you know, some have argued unfairly focus on particularly US multinationals and some of the big tech giants here in the US. That has obviously already driven some Section 301 tariffs, but maybe if we start with France and can try to do a little bit of a flyby around the rest of the world, what remind us what we've seen in France with respect to these tariffs with DST and what may be on the horizon?
This is going to be a real critical point from the trade side, because we in the tax world are constantly thinking the tax impact of this and how impactful that is. I don't think people have been hearing or listening to the same measures that the Trump administration started related to using 301s on the DST. So think of it this way. France, you mentioned, is the one that really first initiated implementation of DSTs. And the thought was, well, if we're going to do this, then we should have a 301 investigation on France and whether or not the digital service tax is unfair to U.S. businesses. And so they sent that out to the U.S. Trade Representative, and sure enough, they found as though that the final proceedings, this is an unfair piece. And so we were actually going to have 25% tariffs on all French goods imported in the United States. So, you know, Doug, I know you're a big wine guy. That was really going to impact your collection, because that was going to be a 25% uplift on the cost of all those wines that you import, you know, every month from France. And that was going to be detrimental. But what happened was that they placed it on hold because they held another investigation with the rest of the countries that were going through and putting together potential DSTs. So Austria, Brazil, Czech Republic, India, Indonesia, Italy, Spain, Turkey, the UK, and overall the European Union. They also found, the trade representative said, that they felt as though that this was also going to be unfair. So this is a card that is out there for the current administration to utilize, so that any country that implements DST, we could see tariff measures coming back on any products that are manufactured there and imported to the United States. And so you think about it from, okay, well, what does this mean if I'm the head of tax? Okay, we're going to might have a cost in our supply chain. What if some of those locations are some of your related party manufacturers, and you have a transfer pricing policy set up, and now there's a 25% tariff that is going to be implemented related to those goods? How are you going to react to that? What are the different options you have related to your supply chain? Can you think about what that means from a planning perspective? And so for me, if I have operations in those locations, either related or unrelated, that I just mentioned, where they're implementing potentially a DST, I would want to make sure I have a game plan ready to say, if those DSTs involve 301 tariffs, what am I going to do? Because I need to do that just like I did for what happened in China. So I'm being proactive in analyzing my company's supply chain and operating model.
Yeah, as we go through the countries that you listed, obviously some are kind of known more for manufacturing than others. I will say for the record that I'm more of a California wine guy than a French, but I certainly enjoy a nice bottle of Bordeaux. And so obviously consumers need to think about that. But to your point on companies' supply chains, you know, one thing that I've certainly seen, particularly doing a lot in the retail and consumer market space, is more manufacturing moving from China to India, for example, amongst other jurisdictions in Southeast Asia. And so, you know, as you mentioned, some of the countries in Western Europe, there are certainly products that we want to be mindful of and appreciate that certain industries, the manufacturing can be anywhere and imports can be coming from anywhere. But India seems one to be very mindful of, and that could really change the economics, particularly for companies that have moved some of their manufacturing or supply chains out of China to India, largely driven for not for tax or trade reasons, but just for the overall cost of manufacturing.
Absolutely. And that's where you really need to think through your global footprint as you're looking at, you know, what you've done or what you're looking to do to your supply chain from a tax perspective. And maybe with the Biden administration, you're thinking about modifying some of the supply chain pieces, changing procurement, changing other aspects of it. But you need to think through what's going to happen on the trade side, not only what's in place, but what might happen with the 301 retaliatory measures. Because, you know, you mentioned all those countries. If those countries are part of your supply chain, you got to keep an eye on them. You got to keep an eye on what's happening in those jurisdictions related to the 301s and that impact.
Yeah, along those lines, and I do want to get to the Made in America executive order that was signed, but just along those lines, how practical is it for companies to lift and shift supply chains as a result of some of these tariffs? So in other words, again, have seen a number of companies over time look at changing the supply chains just to frankly find lower cost of manufacturing and production of products. That obviously takes a lot of time to be able to actually move, you know, all the various aspects of the value chain related to manufacturing to a different country. And then, you know, given the pace of change and how these tariffs have popped up, you know, what have you seen from a practical perspective? Are companies looking to react to these tariffs to then try to lift and shift supply chains? Or is trade really driving some of that behavioral change? Or is it more just general costs? What are you seeing from a practical perspective?
I think when you have third-party suppliers, like we saw in the, you know, from a China perspective, sourcing and changing to manufacturers did go through a dramatic change, especially with third-party suppliers in China. And so a lot of things went to Taiwan, other parts of Asia. And we saw that happening in the operating model. The problem is, what if you own the place? What if you own the manufacturing facility? That's a big capital investment. What are your options? And so we did see some changes where if a company were to, let's say, do part of the manufacturing, a piece of it, and then send it to another country, where it's substantially transformed and it goes under what's called substantial transformation, not to be confused with the tax substantial transformation. This is actually from the customs and duties perspective. What they're looking to do, or what they have done, is companies then have changed the country of origin. So let's say a product was manufactured in China, sent to Taiwan for final assembly. If they can change the HTS classification on the importation of the product so that the actual country of origin changes from, let's say, China to a Taiwan, you go from 25% tariff to a zero. So in the example that we talk about with the DSTs, same thing goes, where if companies are not able to do a lift and shift because it's actually a related party manufacturing facility, then the question becomes, what else can we do? Are there other options? And so lift and shift is a tough one. Perhaps there's something in the middle with substantial transformation. And if that doesn't work, then that's where you look into potential exclusions, duty drawback, and other mitigation when you've already had to pay the tariff.
Got it. Very, very helpful and insightful. So let's turn to on January 25th, President Biden, amongst a flurry of executive orders, signed the Made in America executive order. Can you tell us what is that? And then practically, what, if anything, does that mean? And what should taxpayers, multinationals keep an eye on?
It's definitely an indication of the intentions of the administration. It's akin to when we had FDII introduced on tax reform, where there's incentives for U.S.-based manufacturing, licensing of tangible services. This is to bring things back onshore into the U.S. In fact, it's ensuring future of America is made by America for all American workers. That's part of what they actually talk about in there. And you think about it, just from a U.S. government perspective, $600 billion of federal spending is done every year. Well, now that $600 billion has to go under some preferential treatment for any products that have, like we just got done talking about, a country of origin or where it's been made within the United States. They're going to have the preference related to those contracts compared to the rest of the world. So it's a different spin on incentivizing U.S. Either onshoring, U.S. manufacturing, or when a company is expanding to, say, expand in the U.S. to create more jobs within the U.S. I love that, the fact that we're able to try to motivate that, but it's going to have some incentives so that when you're in the position of a CFO and you're looking at your overall returns and saying, what are my options and modeling of maybe having the manufacturing facility in the U.S. compared to some other locations that are going to have lower cost of labor, but then I have to then factor in freight, but then, you know, what's going to happen with potential tariffs? There's some unknowns there. So it's a really tough situation in today's world, because if you're making big decisions, let's say where you're putting manufacturing, and you're going through this because of an administration from a Made in America executive order, by the time that you've finished maybe the setup of a new facility, we might have a new administration. And are they going to have the same sort of executive order that the Biden administration had? But if the Biden administration gets reelected, then you start to reap some of those rewards. So it's a really challenging time. And I'm hoping that they're going to put some things together to allow for immediate incentives and things that are going to be impactful so that immediately we can see some gains related to the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I mean, uncertainty is the enemy of business, right? I mean, so to your point, if companies are making and these are typically long-term decisions, right, where they put manufacturing, for example, you know, obviously the cost of labor, you know, as we see within the U.S., a lot of automation, robotics involved with manufacturing, which kind of begs the question of how many jobs are we going to actually be adding to the extent that manufacturing comes on shore if most of this becomes, you know, automated. But you know, as I talk to companies, right, the certainty generally as companies are making the decisions can be around cost of labor. And then as they think about tax policy and trade policy, to your point, it's so dynamic. And I think that given how dynamic it's been and the uncertainty, it can cause business leaders to say, well, listen, we can't predict what the heck's going to happen from a tax planning or tax policy perspective. Who knows what's going to happen for these tariffs? And then companies may kind of push that down the order of priority when making those decisions, which is sort of self-defeating for the policies. And so, you know, I think that, you know, certainty is important in this area. And then obviously, given the state of play with BEPS 2.0 and the digital service taxes and then the collateral consequences from trade, it makes it very difficult for business leaders. And the thing is, and we say this a lot of the cross-border tax talks, is modeling becomes critical. And then to your point, it becomes scenario planning and then trying to do some type of probability analysis to factor in what you think might happen as you gaze into the crystal ball.
That's spot on. And we always talk about modeling. It's just so important that your modeling is not just from the tax perspective. It needs to be from multi dimensions. And I think people have learned that, but it's something that we just can't emphasize enough because of the impact both above the line and below the line with every decision that's made in any sort of strategy.
All right, so let's stick with that theme to close things out, Chris. As far as advice that we might have, and maybe if we focus on advice from a tax team perspective. So we started off the podcast talking about how important it is for tax and trade to be connected at the hip, particularly as business model changes are occurring. Obviously, modeling, both from a tax perspective, trade perspective, operational perspective, is something that companies do every day as they're making key strategic business decisions. But in addition to those, what are some best practices or advice that you have for tax teams from a trade perspective?
If I'm the head of tax right now and I am, you know, my company's going to be going through some changes, and even if not, I would make sure I really get to know our trade team. And I would set up monthly, biweekly calls just as check-ins. Here's what we're doing on the tax side. What are you guys going on the trade side? How are things coming together? Anything we need to know about so that we're coordinated. It can't hurt. And it's one of the best practices we've seen. The other thing is, and this is something that I believe most tax people have no idea about, deals with ACE, like Ace of Spades. ACE is the database that is managed by U.S. Customs, and they keep track of every single import and every single export that comes in and out of the United States, and they have a digital database of that that has, goes back over 5 years with over 175 data points for each. And so the third point is when you're doing your modeling, as we talked about a few times already here, make sure the modeling is impactful related to customs, duties, and tariffs, not only today, but what's going on potentially in the future that we're seeing. And that's where those monthly, biweekly meetings with the trade people will help you, because then you can do the what-if scenario planning with them just to make sure you've checked that box. Because the last thing you'd want to do is go down the path of maybe changing your structure, changing part of the supply chain and not considering the trade impacts, going down the path, starting the implementation, and lo and behold, the benefits that you've calculated on the tax side are consumed by the negative aspects on the trade side because something wasn't thought of. And that's the world we live in right now. So those are the three tips I would give, Doug.
Yeah, and you know, if you look at, to go back to France, for example, and how the Trump administration responded, as we think about all the other DSTs and kind of these unilateral measures that, again, are arguably focused on U.S. tech companies, you can kind of see that coming down the line. And so, you know, it's just amazing the number of toggles that we need to have in these models, right? From a U.S. corporate rate perspective, from a GILTI 250 deduction perspective, from a trade and tariffs perspective. Modeling is just amazingly complicated and requires a lot of toggles, to say the least. So Chris, I always feel smarter after talking to you about this stuff. It's fascinating for somebody who has spent his entire career in tax and frankly, you know, have arguably have not had as many discussions with trade as we probably could or should. We certainly think about it in some part of our business model planning, but this really is impacting all aspects of a business and U.S. and foreign-based multinationals. So thanks for coming on and sharing some of your wisdom.
Really happy to do that. And I do have one question for you. You did ask me a question on forecasting. I've got to do the same back to you. So 2021, who's going to win the World Series?
Oh, man. I'm very excited about my Cardinals. But, you know, every year, Chris, if you talk to me, I'm a bigger Cardinal fan than anything else. So I'm going to say the St. Louis Cardinals. This is as good of team as I can remember. And we've had some underperforming starting pitching, which we've just been waiting to really take flight. And so I'm going to say my Cardinals. I think the Mets are pretty stacked as well, given some of their changes. I'm gonna go with the Cardinals, and we'll bring you back on if that happens, and I'll be happy to replay this if that stands true.
Well, so, I know you will. Sounds great, right, Doug. Well, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Chris, and thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks. Thanks again to Chris Desmond, a transfer pricing partner in PwC's Washington National Tax Practice and a leader of PwC's Global Trade Services Practice. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Leader. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of Cross Border Tax Talks.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.